From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's the Staples Singers. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Mavis Staples. For nearly 50 years, she sang gospel with her family. Now she has a new solo album called Have a Little Faith. Next month, the Staples Singers and Jelly Roll Morton will be honored with Lifetime Achievement Awards at the Grammys. Later on, we'll listen to the music of Jelly Roll Morton as performed in our studio by singer Vanell Bonnerice and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews Goodbye Babylon, a collection of early recordings of sacred music nominated for 2 Grammys. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next month at the Grammys, the Staple Singers will be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award. They started performing professionally in 1953, and by the late 50s, the Staple Singers were one of the most popular gospel groups in America. In the early 70s, they crossed over into the pop charts with message songs like Respect Yourself and I'll Take You There. The quartet was led by Pop Staples, and over the years included his son and three daughters. Pop Staples died in 2000. Mavis Staples started performing with the group when she was a teenager. Now she's recording solo and has a new album called Have a Little Faith. Before we listen to a 1989 interview with her, let's hear a song recorded by the Staple Singers in 1968, inspired by Martin Luther King, a friend of the family. It's called The Long Walk to D.C.
It's a long walk to D.C., but I got my walking shoes
on. All the way to Washington.
I can't take a plane, bus, a train, 'cause my money ain't that long. America,
we believe.
Oh, that you love us still.
Love us still.
So people, I'm going up yonder.
Yeah.
To wipe away my tears. I tell you, it's a long walk to D.C.
Yeah.
But I'm on.
I spoke with Mavis Staples in 1989 after she released a solo album co-produced by one of her fans, Prince.
What was your family's reaction when you were young to singing secular songs?
That was a no-no. That was a no-no. In fact, Terry, I got the worst switching of my life for singing a blues song. When I was a kid in school, I was going to school down south at that time in Mount Bayou, Mississippi. And on a variety show, you'd hear Ella Johnson on the jukeboxes, you know, Since I Fell for You. And that song, just I liked it, and I would sing it to myself all the time. So doing a variety show, I knew I wanted to sing, and that song was the song that I was singing at the time. And I actually, my grandmother heard about it, and she gave me this nice little switching forward and let me know that, you know, no one had ever said to me, Mavis, don't sing the blues. Mavis, sing gospel songs only. So this was when I found out that, you know, my family was this, and I still didn't know because I was a kid, you know. But that was the first beginning of Mavis knowing that the Staples family would sing gospel.
Now, your father used to play blues before turning to gospel.
He did. Yes, but mostly just around the house or whatever, not actually on stage. Pops was inspired by guys like John Lemon, Blind John Lemon, and Harlan Wolfe. You know. So when he first started playing his guitar, that was what he was playing. If you notice, you hear a lot of blues licks in the Staple Singers' gospel songs, especially the first things that the first albums that we recorded. Because we had only Pops' guitar. That was the only music we had with us, and maybe a drum beat. But Pops still plays a very bluesy guitar.
It's an electric guitar, too. Is that unusual on the gospel circuit at the time?
Well, it was at that time. In fact, there were no guitars on stage, period.
Was that considered a more devilish instrument?
It certainly was. And Pops had to go to the Bible and let them know. You know, and in fact, I can't quote the exact scripture, Terry, but there is a scripture that it says, we shall rejoice with strings and tambourines. So you have a guitar instrument is a string. And shortly after, you know, when the church people seem to have gotten past it, shortly afterwards, every gospel a singer on the road brought in a guitar, an electric guitar. Pops's was still different. Oh, he had this tremolo on his, you know, and they would call his a nervous guitar. And so, but like I said, shortly after the Staple Singers came with Pops playing his guitar, every group, the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Nightingales, Mighty Clouds of Joy, any group, gospel group that you could name, hired a guitar player.
Well, why don't we hear something from the Staples family?
Okay.
And you're singing lead on this.
Okay.
This is I'm Leaning.
Mm-hmm.
Staples family with Mavis Staples singing lead. You know, listening to you sing, you can't help but think you could have been Aretha Franklin, if you know what I mean. You could have had a lot of that kind of success as a soul singer.
Yes.
Now, you have had lots and lots of success.
Yes.
But did you ever wish ever that you were singing secular songs and on top of the soul charts all the time, and with all of the fame and everything that comes to it attached with that particular kind of secular success?
No, Terry, I really haven't. I was always happy singing with the family. My head just didn't ever go towards the being a solo artist and being at the top like that. I've had offers when I was a teenager, when I was singing with the family, things like Uncloudy Days. In our first years, I'd been offered millions to record secular music. People like VJ Records made offers, and other labels that were out during that time. But it just didn't appeal to me. And I've never felt that I've lost anything by not doing that. I've always felt that, you know, singing with the family and singing the gospel songs was the best for Mavis. But when I started doing these things in 69 with Stax, this too was to just try myself to see just how this would go, and also to enhance what the family was doing. But I've never even dwelled on getting out there like that.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with Mavis Staples. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Glory, glory,
glory, glory.
The Staples Singers will be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award next month at the Grammys. We're listening to a 1989 interview with Mavis Staples.
Tell me how the family started singing together.
Well, we were kids. I guess I may have been about 6 years old. My mother worked nights, and my father worked days. During the day, my mother would keep us, and at night, Pops would keep us. So Daddy was singing with a quartet group at the time. And things weren't going with them. Things weren't going, you know, how you have six or seven guys together. During that time, it's hard for everybody to be, you know, on the same accord and thinking the same. So Pops just decided one night he quit. He couldn't go along with it anymore. And he came home, picked up his guitar, gave each one of us a part. You know, but we were just doing this really to amuse ourselves, Terry, while Pops was babysitting, I suppose. But it was never meant to venture out into making a career of singing.
Well, how did it become a career?
It became a career because we had an aunt, Aunt Katie, one of Daddy's sisters, lived with us. And she heard us rehearsing. She invited us to her church one Sunday. Well, we went out to sing at this church, and we knew one song. The people liked it so much, they clapped us back, and we had to sing that particular song over and over. So Pop said, well, we'll go home and learn some more songs. We recorded Uncloudy Day on a small label called United. And that record, a total gospel record, sold a million, which was unlikely at that time, in 1956. And letters just came from everywhere. Pops, my sisters, my brothers were working. I was still in school. And we were just flooded with these. So Pops said, they thought about it, giving up their jobs and getting out on the road to cover. All these people wanted to hear us and see us. So we just started, it took off from that particular song, Uncloudy Day.
The Staples Singers were, of course, your family group. But not everybody in your family sang. For instance, your mother wasn't in the group.
No, my mother didn't sing. My mother was the typical housewife and mother. She stayed home and encouraged us. In fact, she was the wheel in the middle of the wheel, the backbone of the Staple Singers. My mother, and she knew she didn't have any, all of our singing abilities come from pops. My mom could start singing one song, Precious Lord, and before she's finished with that, she's sang about 10 songs in there. She's giving you a medley. and all out of tune.
When you were a teenager, you were already on the road singing gospel with your family.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of your peers were not with their families. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, when you're a teenager, it's a time usually when people start coming of age sexually.
Oh, yes.
And experimenting with various things.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel held back from that? Being on the road with your father in a gospel group?
Uh-huh. No, I didn't, because I was doing what I enjoyed. And when I came home off the road, I hung with my friends. You know, I was the average teenager. I went to dances and skating rinks, bowling, you know, the everything that, and I had my best friends. I had my boyfriend. I'd write if I, you know, we, during that time, we would only go out maybe 2 weeks at a time. After later years, it got heavier where we'd stay out months at a time. But during that time, we wouldn't stay out any longer than 2 weeks, maybe three. And when we came home, I did everything the average teenager would do. Had all the fun. I went to my prom. You know, I lived my full teenage life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And years later, I felt that when I was ready to get married, I was 24 years old when I married, and for a while, let's say I stayed married for about 7 years. So I've had a full life. Singing gospel and being with my family, I've enjoyed every bit of it. My life has been full. I don't regret, you know, any parts of it.
Did you remarry after that first marriage?
No. No, I didn't. I had kind of a stormy divorce, and I think I kind of, you know, cautioned me into getting married again.
You know what I find interesting about that? You're so associated with a family group,
mm-hmm.
and that you only were married a short time yourself. And
yes. Well, I think mine is because, you know, I was traveling. That had some to do with it. And we were young. My husband was young. At that time, you know, he wasn't quite ready for me leaving home all the time and whatnot, you know. But I wasn't about to stop singing. He never encouraged me to stop singing. But young people in those days, that was a lot for him, you know, for me to be leaving town a lot. And then I kind of married out of the totally. I think maybe I was an entertainment, for an entertainer to marry. I married a mortician.
Oh, really?
So that was really a mismatch, yes. And the first parts of it, the first years of it was nice. But it got to be a bit much, I think, with me leaving town a lot.
Mavis Staples is my guest. Would you describe the church that you grew up in?
I grew up in a Baptist church. Very lively. Where, you know, as soon as the music started, I'd jump up and clap my hands. It was at Mount Eagle Baptist Church. Reverend C.J. Rogers was the pastor then. And I'm still in the same type of environment. I'm at Trinity United Church of Christ now. And we, you know, it's not the sanctified church, but people rejoice in the same way. You know, we have a good time. It's always a good time, church.
In the late 60s, I think it was, the Staple Singers started singing message songs, which
yes.
was a departure from the gospel music. How did you cross over into that?
Well, the message song, actually, we made two transitions. We made one transition first before that message. We went to protest songs. Our first thing was protest songs. That was during the time we were with Dr. King doing the movement. So we'd sing songs like March Up Freedom's Highway and Why Am I Treated So Bad? When Will We Be Paid for the Work We've Done? All right, after we felt that things had gotten a little better, not all the way together, for as far as we were concerned, as far as the black movement went. But after the protest songs, we looked around to see gangs. So we came with Respect Yourself. These are the message songs, Respect Yourself. Songs like this.
I want to play something from that period.
Okay.
And this is I'll Take You There, which was a big hit for
all right.
the Staple Singers. Do you want to say anything about it?
I'll Take You There? No, well, we did this in Muscle Shoals with the Muscle Shoals Alabama guys. Al Bell produced it and wrote it, and I think it's a great song.
The Staple Singers singing I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples singing lead. Mavis Staples is my guest. Most of your message-oriented hits were on Stax Records, mm-hmm. and this is a record company that had a lot of soul singers in
oh,
its
yes.
roster, and went broke in 1975. What effect did that have on the family group?
Well, we felt bad about it. We felt that, you know, because this was another black company after Motown, and it certainly crushed us to see that it was lost. But we had to move on. In fact, we went with Warner Brothers after those days, but we certainly felt bad about it.
One last question. On the album jacket, Time mm-hmm. Waits for No One, the one produced by Prince?
Yes.
It's a fairly sexy cover, you know?
Yeah.
Yes. Are you comfortable with
and
that
I'm
image?
And I'm still sexy, too.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm just wondering if you're comfortable with presenting that kind of sexy
oh, yes,
image.
Yes, yes. That's a part of me.
Okay.
You know, people have a tendency to think that you sing gospel songs and you're an evangelist. You know, or you wear a robe all the time. You walk around with a halo. But no, I'm a woman. And I try to show myself as a woman as much as the next woman. You know, so like I say, you're going to see a lot more of Mavis's personality. There are a lot of little Mavis's off in here, you know. And in this album, Prince is letting it be, no, he grabbed a whole lot of them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music and your life. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry.
Mavis Staples recorded in 1989. Her new CD is called Have a Little Faith. On February 13th, the Staples Singers will be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Bible. Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Delacorte Press, publisher of Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex by journalist Susan Shapiro, and from Warner Home Video, announcing Warner Gangsters, 6 DVD sets featuring Bogart, Cagney, and Robinson at WarnerGangstersDVD.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next month, Jelly Roll Morton will be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. Coming up, we hear his music performed by singer Vernal Bonarice and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen. Also, Ed Ward reviews Goodbye Babylon, a box set of sacred music from the early 1900s. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his own lifetime, Jelly Roll Morton never received the recognition he deserved. Morton may not have invented jazz as he claimed he did, but he's now acknowledged as the first great jazz composer. Next month at the Grammys, he'll be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award. We're going to listen to his music as performed by singer Vernal Bonarice and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen in 1992. At the time, they were performing a cabaret show of Morton's music, which was described by Whitney Balliot in The New Yorker as brilliant. Bonarice and Larsen also performed together in the review One More Time, which was written by Bonarice. More recently, he choreographed the dancing and the club scenes in the movie Ray about Ray Charles. Bonarice is a frequent guest performer and narrator on the public radio jazz concert series Riverwalk. He also sings on a new CD with Orange Kellen's Blues Serenaders. Here's Vernal Bonarice and Morten Gunnar Larsen as recorded in our studio in 1992. The narrative in the excerpts of their show is taken directly from Jelly Roll Morton's oral history as recorded for the Library of Congress.
Anytime you hear anybody playing jazz, what they playing is Jelly Roll. Now, I never got the credit for it, or the cash for that matter, but believe me, it's Jelly Roll. In foreign lands across the sea, they knight a man for bravery. Make him a duke or a count, you see, must be a member of the royalty. Mr. Jelly played a jazzy thing in the temple by the queen and king. All at once he struck upon a harmonic chord. The king said, make Mr. Jelly a lord. He's Mr. Jelly Lord, simply royal at the old keyboard. You should see him strolling down the street. The man's an angel with great big feet. With his melodies, they've made him Lord of the Ivories. Now at home, as well as abroad, they call him Mr. Jelly Lord. Thank you. Now, you may be thinking that it might be a bit egotistical of me naming a song after myself. But really, now, anybody who was anybody in the city of New Orleans at that time, they had a song named after them, usually for heroic reasons, people held high in the minds of their fellow citizens. Not all the time, though. Some people had songs named after them for quite a different reason. A perfect example is a guy I used to play pool with. I couldn't have been no more than 16, 17 years old at the time. Now, he had a song named after him because he was no doubt one of the most heartless men I have ever met. I didn't know it at the time, or else I never would have been playing pool with him. And I certainly would have never beat him at it. But he used to like to play pool with me because he knew that all the piano players at the different bordellos always had plenty cash money. And I was no exception. I'd walk up to the table, throw down my wad and say, "Okay, stand back with your little fives and tens and give my 50s here a chance to breathe." That's what I would say, showing off in front of him. Little did I know that the man I was talking to was Aaron Harris. The man already had 11 killings to his name. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Now he's the baddest man ever was on this land. I tell you, between people like Aaron Harris and Hoodoo and the racial prejudice that existed in New Orleans at that time, I found that I had to leave the city where I was born and raised and had truly come to love in my heart.
That's wonderful. And that's Vernell Bonnerice and Morten Gunnar Larsen at the piano. And everything that you say in the show is from the Library of Congress recordings.
Yeah, they're all truly Jelly's words and Jelly's music as Jelly intended it to be heard.
Have you tried to get the inflection of his voice when you've been listening to the records?
I'm from New Orleans. I don't have to try that.
Well, you brought it up. You're from New Orleans, and like Jerry Lerone Morton, you're a Creole, too.
Yeah. I'm
wondering, when you were growing up, were you listening to a lot of his music? Were your parents listening to a lot of his music?
Not my parents, but my grandmother. There was a generation skip there. My grandmother knew of Jelly Roll, and she's the one that told me the stories about the Lyric Theater, which led to One More Time, an evening at the Lyric Theater in 1926. So she had all of that vaudeville and gospel influence. My parents went more for Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra and that sort of Americana that was moving into the culture at that point, thanks to television. But my grandmother held to her memories and shared them with me, and it was a real treat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Vernell Bonnerice. With us also is Morten Gunnar Larsen, the pianist with the show. And Morten, I'm going to ask you to do a piano solo. And I heard this while you were rehearsing, and it's quite amazing. So do you want to introduce it at all before you play it?
Yes, I may. It's a piece that probably Morten composed rather late in his life after coming to New York City. He wanted to, really show him off as a brilliant piano player. And when he met the stride piano players in New York, like Fats Waller, Duke Ellington, James P. Johnson, and others, he wanted to make a piece of a real technical virtuosity. He always thought of his own music as very melodic and saw that as quite superior to technical brilliance. But he needed to make this piece simply, I think, also to make a bit of caricature of the stride piano tradition. So he called it simply the Finger Breaker.
I'm out of breath just listening to that. That's fantastic. That's Morten Gunnar Larsen with the music of Jelly Roll Morton. Morton, what is the difference that you hear between ragtime pianist and Jelly Roll Morton, who, although he wrote rags, I don't really think of him as a ragtime pianist?
No, definitely. He looked on himself as the first important jazz pianist, really. And there's a very important difference in that ragtime is composed music. When you think of the Scott Joplin rags, for instance, everything is written down, just like in European classical music, whereas early jazz piano is improvised in a language that is a lot freer than ragtime. Morton used to love to demonstrate that difference with Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag.
Sure, do you want to do
I can just show you very quickly. If you play it very strict the way Joplin wrote it, it has a almost baroque feeling, I call it sometimes, because it's very... precise like that, but Morton liked to slow the tempo down a little bit to give room to play with the different phrases a bit more and to leave in some blue notes, for instance, and also square out the rhythm a little bit so it would sound like...
Yeah, that's a nice demonstration of the differences. And I should say, you know, Morton, like Joplin, composed his music. I've heard he even composed the solos for the people in his band.
Yeah, that's true. So, he was very peculiar of his music too, but still looked at this as organized form of jazz, of course.
We're listening to a 1992 performance and interview featuring singer Vernell Bonnerice and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jelly Roll Morton will be honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys next month. We're listening to his music as performed in our studio in 1992 by singer Vernell Bonnerice and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen. You know, Morton was demonstrating before the difference between, say, Scott Joplin and Jelly Roll Morton playing a rag. I think with Morton singing, there's something very kind of behind the beat about it. I wonder how you would characterize his singing. Maybe as composed to other people who sang in the period.
Oh, it's very different from, for example, what you would think of in vaudeville. Like when I play Papa Do, they write on, it's practically a direct delivery from the sheet music. But he likes to lay back and taste it before delivering it. Like a cook would taste to see if there's enough salt in it before you put it out there. And I love... His delivery it has nothing to do with sheet music. So by listening to him for years and years, I was able to get myself to lay back. I don't know if I'm laying back exactly when he does, but it has that general quality to it.
Can I get you to do a couple of bars in the vaudeville style of that period to contrast it?
Yeah, hooey. Yes.
Cakewalkers may come.
Yeah, I just thought of that tune. Yeah, why don't we do that? Whatever key you want.
Yeah, is it B-flat?
Yeah,
that'd
be fine.
Okay.
Cakewalkers may come, cakewalkers may go, but I want to tell you about a couple I know. They high-stepping gals and debonair. When it comes to business, not a soul can compare.
Like that.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's right on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like them both.
Okay. That helps.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is a recording of Bessie Smith doing that one, and she does it a lot slower and lays back, right, you know, like
right.
a jazz performer would do.
Vernell, has doing this Jelly Roll Morton show given you a different perspective at all on New Orleans, where you're from? You know, going back and listening to his stories of coming of age there? And
yes. It's a little frightening for me sometimes in the middle of the show because I look so much like this photograph that they have of Jelly Roll Morton on the wall. And
that's the truth. I mean, you really do look a lot like him.
It's incredible, particularly when I have on the...
the apparel.
Pimp, yeah.
the
old
stuff.
Pimp apparel. But... yeah, there's a continuum for me that I feel in his stories, and hearing his accent is like hearing any uncle of mine uh-huh. talk. And so there's I feel like I'm carrying the flag on, or the fire like they do in the Olympics, you know. But I feel like I'm just passing it through, and it's been nice.
One of the things, at least one of the things that you do in the voice of Jelly Roll Morton, there's a reference to spells, and one of his pieces is Grandpa Spells. Were you exposed to spells and that when you were in
yeah.
New Orleans?
Yeah, definitely. That's just part of the everyday life.
Because it always sounds so exotic to outsiders.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Was that through your grandmother?
No, that was through everybody. You do the little things, you know, like if somebody comes over and you don't particularly care for them to come back anymore. When they're leaving, you roll an onion behind them. you know, just things that there's a 1,001 varieties of little things that you can do to sort of assure that this happens for you. It's very mixed, you know, when you come from there. The Roman Catholic ritual is extremely mixed up with the old voodoo thing. So, and then so they call it white voodoo instead of black voodoo or something, but it's all so crazy and mixed up that you just colorfully go along your way.
Well, let's close with another song from the
okay.
show. Do you know another song for us?
Yes.
Sweet Substitute.
That's a good one. She's mine, all mine. Does anything I tell her, love is blind. She's got such loving ways, always got my head in a daze. She's mighty cute, my new recruit, my sweet substitute. Don't want no regulars, my sweet substitute.
Beautiful. Thank you both so much for coming and performing for us. It's
thank you.
Really
it's
been a delight. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Singer Vernell Bonnarice and pianist Morton Gunnar Larson recorded in 1992. Bonnarice is featured on a new CD by Orange Kellen's Blues Serenaders. Coming up, Ed Ward reviews a new anthology collecting early recordings of sacred music. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
The religious revivals of the 19th century were filled with music, and by the time the recording industry got going in the 1920s, some of the best of that music was only a few decades old and got captured on record. Rock historian Ed Ward reviews Goodbye Babylon, an impressive anthology of sacred music.
Late in 2003, a previously unknown Atlanta company called Dust to Digital released a remarkable set of CDs. Over the course of five discs, it has 134 songs taken from old 78s, arranged by theme. Given the breadth of styles and the conceptual overview, it brings to mind Harry Smith's classic Folkways anthology of American folk music, except for one thing. While Smith covered every kind of folk music he could find, this set, called Goodbye Babylon, deals only with sacred music. There's even an additional disc, which I admit I haven't played yet, containing 25 sermons, which were also issued on 78s. Daunting is one word to describe it, but I noticed something else as I played through the set for the second time a few days ago. It's also highly entertaining. It could scarcely not be. Every kind of American music is represented, from good time pop jazz, to mountain music, to blues, to what could only be called punk.
There ain't no grave.
Brother Claude Eli's recording of Ain't No Grave Gonna Hold My Body Down is one of the few post-war recordings on the set, which also contains the oldest surviving recording of black performers.
Down on the old campground, coon shouts by the Dinwiddie Colored Quartet.
There's a jubilee, there's a jubilee, there's a jubilee away down the old campground. There's a jubilee, there's a jubilee.
The little white stone came rolling down.
Went down the old campground.
And it rolled like thunder to the ground.
Went down the old campground.
You say you're aiming for the sky.
Went down the old campground.
And don't you stop your telling lies.
Went down the old campground. Oh, the jubilee.
The Dinwiddie Colored Quartet recorded this in 1902. And you'll notice that the announcer calls it a coon shout rather than a spiritual. This is because the last verse has no religious content at all, being the familiar, down in the henhouse on my knees, I thought I heard a chicken sneeze verse. Racist? Yes, but one of the few surviving recordings of minstrelsy. The Dinwiddies may have made their living on the stage, but the majority of the artists on Goodbye Babylon were sacred singers by profession. They range from the utterly unknown, like Luther Magby, who, the booklet says, is known only to have made one record and to have died, to the justly celebrated.
God's gonna separate the wheat from the tear, didn't he say? God's gonna separate the wheat from the tear, didn't he say?
A young, jazzy Mahalia Jackson, recorded in 1937, decades before she became famous, is just one of the surprises here. One of the regularly occurring ones is just how odd some of these records are, from the novelty instrument played by Washington Phillips to the unearthly sounds of the otherwise unknown blind Mamie Forehand.
See?
That's probably the bell from a hotel front desk keeping time, incidentally. And if you've never heard Sacred Harp singing, a ghostly leftover from the 19th century, there's lots of that here, too. No, you didn't understand the lyrics. Sacred harp singers chant the solfeggio, the do, re, mi syllables of the song first, then go into the words. Like the Harry Smith collection, Goodbye Babylon is the sound of an era ending. The Reverend Thomas A. Dorsey makes a couple of appearances here, and the songs he composed would help usher in a new era after World War II, the era of gospel music. What's on these five discs in their handsome wooden box, packed with cotton balls, is the last American sacred folk music, more or less. You certainly don't have to be a believer to be entertained and intrigued by these songs, nor to be thankful that someone put together this collection.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed the new box set, Goodbye Babylon, on the Dust to Digital label. It's nominated for 2 Grammys. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Kevin Bacon talks about his career, from his early films like Diner and Footloose to his latest movies, including Mystic River and The Woodsman. In The Woodsman, he plays a sex offender just released from prison. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.